Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable. The story of Flacco, the Eurasian eagle owl, who escaped from Central Park Zoo, captured the hearts and imaginations of millions of followers around the world. Flacco has been dubbed the world's most famous bird. From the night in February of 2023, when vandals cut a hole in his cage, until his death a year later in a courtyard on the Upper West Side, his is a story full of adventure and unexpected turns. In his latest book, The Book of Flacco, the world's most famous bird, nature writer David Gessner chronicles the year-long odyssey of Flacco and the human drama that followed the owl. It is a great pleasure to welcome David Gessner to the Roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks, Joe. Thanks for having me, and thanks for doing a little of my work for me. I usually have to summarize Flacco's year, and you did it very well.
Well, you know, it was well. Thank you very much. You know, I am fascinated by the story because obviously, you know, there was that whole Free Flacco movement that took place,
right.
And so I guess when does this start to come on your radar as something that you would be interested in writing about?
Well, I just had a cold walk in New York City where I'm back to promote the book. And I didn't spend much time, even though I grew up in Massachusetts, I didn't spend much time in New York. But my daughter going to NYU was kind of the decisive reason I ended up writing about Flacco. In fact, it's kind of funny. My wife is a novelist. She had a best-selling novel called The Christie Affair.
Yep.
And her next book, too, was also about New York. So I think we were both not letting go of our child. That was part of the motivation for the writing. So during the Flacco year, I heard about him, and I went out to Central Park and looked, and I did not find him. But then I got interested in the story, and I happened to be up here visiting my daughter the day that Flacco died, which is the anniversary is coming up. It's February 23rd. And I thought, you know, I looked around and there was a New Yorker piece and a New York Times tribute, but no one seemed to be tackling it in long form. So I went out and interviewed a guy named David Barrett, who was the head of Manhattan Bird Alert, who was really the kind of maestro of organizing. You know, he had 100,000 followers on Twitter, organizing people to follow Flacco through the park and then through the city. And it was a great interview in the morning. Then I walked across and I got to the zoo and I saw the small enclosure that Flacco had been inside. And I talked to a maintenance guy who was very, you know, open, unlike the zoo was later about Flacco, and told me, oh, they must have snuck around the cameras here. So he kind of became my deep throat of the Flacco story. And then that night I went and had cocktails with Nan Knighton, who was not a birder or a nature person, but she had been in her Fifth Avenue apartment, 13th floor, one day in October when Flacco flew up to her window and stared in with blazing orange eyes for 3 hours, and she was captivated by it, got kind of obsessed with Flacco. And at Thanksgiving, a couple weeks later, her daughters kept looking over at her and kind of pointing at her, and she said, "What? What is it?" And one of them said, "You sure talk about that owl a lot." And so Nan became obsessed the way so many New Yorkers and people around the world ended up being with Flacco.
So why do you think there was such an interest in the story? I mean, it's a compelling story, but a bird got loose. And what was it about this bird and about the story that linked it to make it something that people felt so deeply about?
Well, I think for starters, Eurasian eagle owls are the largest owls. Blakiston's fish owls are competitive, but so it's a big bird. And of course, being an owl, it has forward-facing eyes, binocular vision like humans, and those big orange eyes, and it emoted a lot. I'm doing a kind of PowerPoint along with the talks I'm giving, and it's just, he's a bird of 1,000 faces. And he was pretty easy to see. So on the first day, he's just kind of learning to fly because he's been in a cage for a dozen years, or 13 years, but a dozen years in New York. And he flies in kind of little fits and starts, doesn't hoot, but he makes it into the park the next day where a dozen bird watchers kind of go and look at him. And then the next day, 100, and there are a dozen members of the press watching the dozens of bird watchers. And all of a sudden, you know, he becomes known in a way he couldn't have been known 20 years ago, right, around the world. And the thing about Flacco was he was not he was willing to sit there and be stared at from up close. And people got this kind of glimpse of a wild in an urban setting that was extremely attractive and kind of took on the sense of a fable as Flacco started to regain his skills that evolution had gifted him. You know, somebody said early on, it's like he owns a Maserati but doesn't know how to drive.
Yeah.
So the real excitement came when he started to drive, when he caught his first rat, you know, when he coughed up his first pellet, and suddenly he was flying longer distances, he was hooting, he was doing all the things that, you know, he was kind of becoming himself, becoming larger. And I think that's the kind of peak moment of excitement when people are like, oh my God, he's broken out of the cage, and maybe we can break out of the cage.
He was not broken. I mean, he didn't break out of the cage, though. He was helped and in this. And I just wonder, what was it? Do we know the motivation of why that was even done?
We have no idea. You know, the term often used is vandals, but you know, some people use the term liberators.
Right.
And we don't know if it was some PhDs from Columbia who synapses snapping had a discussion of zoo ethics that night, or a drunk kid, you know. So, but we do know that he slowly, you know, flew out of there. And while he didn't break out, he did thrive early on in the park, you know, where he had landscapes not unlike some that he might have had in his home territory. You know, I ended up going to Finland to see Eurasian eagle owls in the wild. And, you know, and there were parts of it that didn't look too different than the Loch or the Ramble in Central Park.
Is it safe to say, though, David, that anyone who had any knowledge or maybe even an ounce of common sense knew that if an owl who had been held in a zoo for 12 or 13 years, that when it was let out, the prospects were not good?
Yeah, I guess it's safe to say, but there were, you know, there were varying opinions, and you could argue that had Flacco stayed in the park and not launched off into the city at Halloween, like 8 months after he broke out of the cage or was released from the cage, you know, one thing about the park is they do not use rat poison. It doesn't mean rats can't wander in from outside, but, you know, there's not rat poison, and there's less likelihood of car collisions. And he wasn't eating pigeons, which ultimately did him in that much in the park. So he did better than a lot of the experts expected. And what finally got him was basically, you know, that's why I have a chapter of, like, kind of Flacco as Rachel Carson, because the rat poison weakened him, the rodenticide, which is very common in urban birds, but also in birds all over the country. And pigeon herpivirus, which really might have been the thing that finally killed him. What was falsely reported quite a lot was that it was a building collision. It really was, you know, he was not a migrating bird. Building collisions kill a billion birds a year. But he was in a concrete courtyard on the Upper West Side, weakened by those poisons, and he fell from his perch and hit a video camera on the way down and hit the ground. That's where the contusions came from.
What was it about? I mean, it seems in the book, and correct me if I'm wrong here, but once he left the zoo, there were sightings almost immediately, and was regularly sighted throughout until his death, right?
Yeah, it had some, you know, it was in the park, it was regularly sighted, though it did disappear a couple times. And then it flew down to the Lower East Side, actually ended up two blocks from my daughter's dorm, and And it, you know, there were periods when people didn't see it. And then after it returned to the park, it spent its last days on the Upper West Side. And I'm looking out my hotel window here in Union Square, and I see three water towers. And I never really noticed water towers that much in New York until I, you know, was given a tour. And Flacco's favorite haunts were way up on top where he could see everything and hooting down. But he had days where he disappeared and people didn't follow him. But a lot of his, you know, that's another aspect of the story that really interests me, the notion that we live in a world of screens. And, you know, he was constantly being filmed and the people filming him were being filmed. And it was kind of a Hall of Mirrors thing where, you know, it was like Flacco was the celebrity and we were the paparazzi.
What were the, given that there were regular sightings, what were the efforts to try to recapture Flacco?
Well, those came early on. And the zoo, which was in a really tough position, because they were doing it by a weekend, the world was watching, and so they were trying to recapture him without hurting him, because that would have been disastrous. And then when Flacco finally seemed like he could take care of himself, that he was catching rats and he seemed to be thriving, flying better, they stopped, and they said they would just monitor him. And from then on, there were no attempts. The interesting thing is, I feel like the zoo missed an opportunity. They kind of withdrew from the story. But essentially what was going on in the park was a movable zoo. You know, people were doing exactly what they do in zoo, particularly in an inner city zoo, where young people were watching. And the zoo's mission is to entertain and educate. And they could have had somebody out there kind of saying, this is a Eurasian eagle owl, and it's known for, you know, and that didn't happen. So Flacco was free for the rest of his life. And you know, it was a short life. It was 1 year. He would have been 14 in about a month after he died. But it really was turned, I mean, I was a little skeptical when I first approached the story. But the more I met these Flacco followers or Flaccolites, the more I really believed that they not only cared deeply, but they were mourning after he died.
You make this point, but Flacco was an immigrant in the city.
Yeah, there were a lot. Everybody had their kind of meanings for Flacco, right? And there was, you know, there was a whole more scientific side that looked down on the anthropomorphizing of Flacco. But for me, an interesting thing, you know, people talk about freedom a lot, but yeah. I think freedom in this day and age is kind of used in different ways in the political world. So I like to think in terms of space. Like suddenly he went from this incredibly constrained space to having this larger territory. And there's a Henry David Thoreau quote, which is, I like a broad margin in my life. And I thought Flacco did too, you know. And so for me, I'm kind of an old school Barovian nature guy who likes to be out there alone. I used to track snowy owls on Cape Cod. But this turned me on to this group thing. And it was a real community around him. And it brought people together, post-COVID, in a really interesting way.
The name of the book is The Book of Flacco, The World's Most Famous Bird, and it's published by Blair. David Gassner, thank you so much for being with us. It's a fascinating story, and I thank you so much for sharing it with us.
Thank you, Joe.
Be well. Thank you. Again, the name of the book is The Book of Flacco, The World's Most Famous Bird. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.